I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas on Science and Self-Awareness.
Genes had the capacity to redefine the subject, the person, in its entirety, in every cell. So the importance of genetics is in the history of the disembodiment, the disincarnation of your own orientation, the answer to the question, who am I? Genes have entered into being the answer to who am I?
When Danish botanist Wilhelm Johannsen coined the term gene in the early years of the 20th century, he described it as a very applicable little word. And so it has turned out. Once a purely scientific and technical term, it is now spread into common daily use. People speak familiarly of my genes and your genes. Newspapers report on the latest gene find. And an American company now offers anybody with $1,000 and a saliva sample the chance to have their genome mapped. Under the slogan, "Genetics just got personal," the company's website invites browsers to find out what your genes say about you. But what happens when a scientific term migrates from the lab to the street in this way? What does the word gene signify in everyday speech? The question is posed by two German scholars, Barbara Duden and Celia Samersky. For several years, they've been pondering what they call the pop gene, the gene in popular culture. And today on Ideas, they'll talk about what they've found out. You'll hear first from Barbara Duden, and then in the second half of the hour from Celia Samersky, as we continue with our series, How to Think About Science. Here's Ideas producer David Cayley.
Most talk about genetics is concerned with what genes do, with whether this or that gene gives you blue eyes or a good golf swing or an increased risk of heart disease. Barbara Duden is concerned with what genes say, with what they tell people about who and what they are. Duden is an historian and a pioneer in the field she calls body history, the history of how people have actually experienced embodied existence. When she began writing history in the 1970s, her fellow historians still tended to diagnose the illnesses of people in the past in modern scientific terms. Barbara Duden's innovation was to take her historical subjects at their own word. In her first book, The Woman Beneath the Skin, she drew on the case records of an 18th century German physician to bring to light the vivid ways in which women had felt and imagined their pains and pleasures in an age before objective measures of the body's condition were available. Her second book, Disembodying Women, looked at the contemporary female body. Mapped, monitored, and measured as the 18th century body had never been, but also objectified, deprived of its story and its voice. Her current work on genes carries on with this theme of disembodiment. We spoke about this work in an interview we recorded at her home in Bremen in the spring of 2007. The popular image of the gene, she told me, sums up a deep change in the practice of medicine that she thinks began in the 1970s. She gives the example of hormone replacement therapy, the artificial supplementation of hormone levels in women around the time of menopause.
In hormonal replacement therapy, we could recognize that there was a totally new logic that came about, because hormonal replacement therapy is not a therapy in the sense in which there is someone sick and then you do a therapy. And also when a physician would say, oh, you take this or you take the hormonal replacement, he doesn't give a diagnosis because the woman isn't sick, she's just getting older. But he will tell her, oh, yes, when you are 30 years older, when you fall down the stairs, you will break your bones. So it's better to do now something. So when you fall down, your bones won't be as brittle. So propagation of risk consciousness and risk management. And we could see this in not only in hormonal replacement therapy, but in many practices, that physicians had changed from dealing with the sick to managing risky selves, to managing people who are perfectly healthy, but are afraid something might happen in the future and are being told in what sense they could manage their present being better, so in the future they have better chances. And this transformation of the flesh as the stuff that's in the ordinary is very well and only in certain instances when you are sick, so you need a physician, that now needs constant rectification, investigation, monitoring, if it mightn't be already sick, even if you don't feel it yet. And it seemed to us that genes where that Trojan horse through which risk consciousness would be implanted into not only into your interior, but into every cell. So that in every cell, in every the very substance of your being, the gene is the incarnation of risk.
Barbara Duden decided to test her surmise that genes constitute the Trojan horse by which risk awareness is implanted in people's bodies. She and her younger colleague, Celia Samirsky, whom you'll be hearing from later on, began to look into the ways in which genes were infiltrating everyday life. As part of this research, they conducted interviews in a German village, a place at the dead end of a rural road, but still nearby a university town with a celebrated institute of molecular biology. There, they found that everyone spoke freely and confidently about genes.
The first thing that struck us was that this term had been popularized so much that in this small village in the south of Germany, everyone would very vividly talk about genes. So the word has really entered into ordinary conversations. So the woman in the bakery, the woman who is cutting hair, the minister, we spoke with the minister of the village, he would pontificate that God made the genes. And then the woman who is cutting the hair would talk about the genes and cancer. And the local physician would talk about that drunkenness is really genetically determined. And so there are all these stories, wild, wild stories. So first, it was the astonishing richness of this popular gene talk.
What Barbara Duden calls the richness of popular gene talk results, in her view, from the fact that the term has no precise denotation for the people using it. No one could satisfactorily define it, and many had fanciful ideas about the form and location of genes. This lack of definition, according to Duden, is one of the keys to the word's remarkable power. It can signify so many different things, beginning with heredity.
We spoke with the woman who sold the sausages because she was explaining over the counter to the client. She said, oh, the chromosomes were as long as this. And she demonstrated with her finger the length of the chromosomes. So she had a genetic counseling and we were interested what was left with her. And what we found out is, first, genes stand in for how you are in your very flesh, because you are the daughter of this mother and grandmother and so on. So she would say, yeah, I can see in my children, this is the genes of their father, how they sit there. They sit like him, or they are, one daughter is unruly. He also was in his child very unruly. So this is her genes. This is her genes. We can see it. So it is like a synonym for saying, this is how she is, because she is the daughter or the granddaughter of this person. So genes also then stand in for something that is given, handed over in inheritance.
The second set of meanings that people connected with genes had to do with risk, Barbara Duden found. Genes point to troubles which may break out in the future, as another woman from the village explained.
She would speak about that. She says, but you know, maybe the gene is like a capsule. So it sits there and then suddenly it opens. And you don't know when it will open. Maybe you ran too fast or you did something wrong and then suddenly it opens and then a sickness comes. So it's she speaks about gene in the image of a latent threat. Not something that's given, but it's already there, but latently it may show up in something wrong that comes up with you.
Genes can refer to risk, they can refer to heredity, and they can refer finally to the possibility of bringing life under a new kind of management. A number of her interviewees, Barbara Duden says, evoked a utopia in which genetic manipulation would erase every inconvenience of the human condition.
I take the example of the woman who was selling the sausages in the village, that she would talk about at length how ultimately with genes you could redesign the human being so that everyone has just blonde hairs or whatever, and all these bio-fantasies, what could be done. And also what was very important was that when they were talking about the possibility of manipulation, then there are all these ideas that in grave sickness, genetic research ultimately would be the answer to any sickness. So the gene is tied to hopes and promises of a future being where there is no sickness, no old age, you don't have to die and so on. So a possibility where the human being in its flesh could be manipulated, remade and redesigned in its entirety.
Barbara Duden thinks that people understand genes in confusing and contradictory ways. The word, for her, operates in two very different registers. Genes signify something intimate, tangible, and personal. The eyes I share with my mother. The walk that makes people mistake me for my father at a distance. And at the same time, they point to an intangible and impersonal realm of risk, dependency on experts, and the possibility that everything might be about to change. And the effect of these discordant registers, Duden says, is to throw people off balance.
With genes, anything may be possible. Anything could happen. And because there are so many contradictory dimensions that pertain to this word, I think people lose the ground on which they can orient themselves. They really become dependent on professional counseling. Yeah. Gene is a word that destroys the very possibility in which you say, I'm well, I feel well, we'll see what happens in the future. I'm in the now, I know from where I come, and I act accordingly. With genes, there may be already something, even you don't feel it. There may be already a defect in yourself that will show later. You cannot really influence it, so it's destined, while at the same time you've got continually to investigate it and see and manage. If you can manage your chances better. And at the same time, it is something that might be able to change the face of the world in its entirety. And even you can't say no to it because it is related in the perception, it's related to ultimate promises of the annihilation of sickness, getting old and so on. So it's an extremely powerful term, and it's extremely powerful because of these contradictory modalities that come together in the word. While at the same time, it says something about who you are and the next one is. Yeah. So we thought that the most important effect of genes is not in the sphere of science, but in the symbolic fallout of gene talk that bring about pop genes
The POP gene, as Barbara Duden sees it, derives its power from its ability to bind so many different ways of talking together into one word. It embodies and reconciles contradictions, holding together what she calls different spheres of existence.
The word covers spheres that ordinarily cannot be covered in one word, from a word for where you came from, very personal, to a word that's apt for, we could say, the management of hope, a word that elicits possibilities of what could be done to the human condition. And that is tied, of course, to experts or research that ultimately in the laboratory would find something so that the human condition could be unhinged, could be, in a deep sense, changed.
The POP gene builds a bridge between personal life and the scientific laboratory Barbara Duden found. The scientific gene, by definition, is something that can exist only in a fully equipped laboratory. And even there, the boundaries of the object will change with the ebb and flow of scientific knowledge. Indeed, some scientists now argue that the advance of genetics has turned the very idea of genes into a misleading oversimplification of the complex mechanisms of heredity and development. The POP gene bypasses these difficulties. The peculiar and exacting conditions underlying the production of scientific facts are erased, and the gene becomes an everyday object, as real as any other object of sense. The gene is naturalized, Barbara Duden says, made into an intimate part of one's own nature. Her concern about this is that she thinks it conflates spheres of life that are of radically different kinds. Again and again in her work, she has drawn attention to the danger she sees in this merging of the personal and the technical. For example, in her book Disembodying Women, she talks about ultrasound scanning of the pregnant womb and argues that a crucial distinction must be preserved between the expected child and the ghostly apparition on the ultrasound screen.
The ultrasound screen is a technical device for the discovery of abnormalities. So the physician looks and screens and checks about whether the unborn has no fault or no is according to the average, while the woman sees the child she's going to love. So you have a merging between a monitoring or screening gaze to an object to be evaluated according to standards and the emotion for your next that you love. And this merging of technical supervision and most intimate and delicate and deep perception of love that you see your dearest to come, while at the same time you see it within a frame in which its quality is being evaluated. And if it's not according to quality, you may be asked to make the decision to get rid of it.
Barbara Duden wants to maintain a firm distinction between the realm of technoscience and the personal realm, between the objectified fetus picked out by the ultrasound scan and the beloved to come. She sees the gene, in an analogous way, as belonging to an entirely different order from the lived body. Let this distinction break down, implant the gene in the living flesh, she says, and human personality itself changes.
Genes had the capacity to redefine the subject, the person, in its entirety, in every cell. So I think when we look back, we can say that the gene, quote unquote, the gene was important to redefine the person in its past, present, and orientation towards the future, in its very flesh. So the importance of genetics is in the history of the disembodiment, the disincarnation of your own orientation. The answer to the question, who am I? genes have entered into being the answer to who am I, and the answer to who am I in my flesh is deeply contradictory and especially disorienting, and you lose your common sense. You lose your, the moment you believe in genes, you incarnate a destiny that's already given, while at the same time you are called forth to manage or to say to do good risk management, and at the same time you have to, it ties people to experts. Even so, the expert ultimately can't help you.
If you believe in genes, Barbara Duden says, you lose your common sense. Her statement, as I understand it, says nothing whatsoever about the gene as a scientific construct. Scientific constructs, in any case, do not invite our belief. They require the kind of careful and qualified assent which is only possible for those who actually know something about the complex reality that a term like gene summarizes and simplifies. What Duden is arguing is that such scientific terms have a mystifying and disorienting effect when they stray into what she calls the prose of everyday speech. There, she says finally, the gene simply has no place.
The word is an alien in our prose. It is something that unhooks one's perception in one's biology in the traditional sense, the way how I can make meaning of my own life. Yeah, the difficulty is that I cannot incarnate a scientific gene because the scientific gene pertains to statistical populations, if you want to talk about it. But people orient in the flesh. And then when gene talk implants genes as the cause for something. In the pop gene, genes become the cause for that that is, and in this sense maybe also the cause for something that might happen in the future. So then when you ascribe that to yourself, you ascribe to yourself a contradictory mode of how you orient in your existence, because then you incarnate, you incorporate a cause of your being that is on the one side destined, but also has the aspect of the conditionality. It may be dangerous, it may be fearful. It's there, but you can't feel it. It may show in the future. So it takes the bottom out of your sensual experience, yeah. And this cannot be mended by demanding genetic literacy, because the genetic literacy will further estrange people from the only way I think we can really orient, which is to trust your own sense, to trust the experience that you made in your life as a person in flesh and blood, where you know something. Yeah. And when you speak about genetic knowledge, this is it makes you totally dependent on whatever they tell you, because it cannot be reached by what you actually know.
So what for you is the proper relationship between everyday living and scientific knowledge?
I think the older I get, it's not good for very much. It's not very helpful. It's really not very helpful. We can analyze it as a social scientist, that gene talk has been good as a resource for all type of things, the management of hope, to hook people that they think ultimately medicine will be able to annihilate sickness and so on. But for your daily experience, it's not helpful. It doesn't help you. For your daily experience, it's very important to stick to your senses, or the leftovers of senses that there are in the very flesh, I think. It's a problem of the academics that they disincarnated or disembodied their orientation. So they take the world as the outcome of experiments in the laboratory. But the beauty, the real world, the I, and the you, where we are real, is rooted in the senses. Yeah. To be alive, you must sit in your flesh, no? That's the most important. Yeah.
Barbara Duden, recorded at her home in Bremen in the spring of 2007. Barbara Duden is professor at the University of Hanover and the author of The Woman Under the Skin and Disembodying Women.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. The program is called How to Think About Science, and it's presented by David Cayley.
The word gene traces back to the beginning of the last century, when William Bateson gave the infant science of genetics its name. But it was not till DNA was modeled in the 1950s that the gene was given a precise form and location. A gene was a stretch of DNA which comprised the blueprint, so to say, for some part or propensity of the organism. Since then, as the science has grown in subtlety and refinement, genetics has largely dispensed with simple, mechanical, deterministic images of how genes work. But at the same time, genes have entered popular culture as the quasi-mythic power that Barbara Duden has been describing in the first half of today's program as the pop gene, the gene that haunts everyday conversation in a German village. Pop genes are put into circulation in various ways. The media need a handle on genetics, and genetics itself needs an icon of its power and promise as a science. Medicine, too, plays its part. And here we come to the work of Barbara Duden's colleague Celia Samirsky, which will be my subject in the remainder of today's program. Samirsky sat in on the genetic counseling sessions that doctors give to pregnant women in Germany, and later published her reflections on these sessions in a so far untranslated book entitled The Mathematization of Hope. We spoke in the spring of 2007 in Bremen, where she lives, and she told me that her interest in genetics traces back to the time in the late 1980s when she went to the University of Tübingen.
I started studying biology in Tübingen, and I was, as quite a few of my colleagues, interested in nature. But we soon found out that biology is not about nature at all. That was pretty disappointing, actually. And then they started to change the whole structure of the field of biology. They cut down the classical disciplines like botany, zoology, and so on, and they started to build a center for gene technology. You know, all these changes that have taken place in biology the last 20 years maybe. And that just started when I was there. And students, or quite a few students, opposed that change, because we were very critical about gene technology. First of all, we thought it's a risk technology. It's risky. Then it's not about nature, understanding nature. It's a technology. It's about, you know, changing something. It's about making money. So I think that was how it started.
Celia Samirsky and her fellow students were unsuccessful in their efforts to convince the University of Tübingen to turn away from gene technologies. But in the course of her critical work on the issue, she concluded that she needed to know more about what she was dealing with.
I thought maybe I should take the chance and study human genetics, since I was already doing some political work on genetics. I thought maybe that's a good idea, not only to criticize it, but to go inside of it and really study it and see how these institutions work and really get into it. So I did that. I chose human genetics as my main discipline. And so I had one leg outside of the laboratory, discussing with my friends critically the political and social consequences of genetics, and one leg With one leg, I was standing inside of the laboratory, watching everything or even doing genetics myself. That was very fruitful, I think.
Celia Samirsky earned her diploma in human genetics at Tübingen in 1996. During the course of her studies there, she became aware of the phenomenon that would eventually become the subject of her doctoral dissertation at the University of Bremen, genetic counseling.
When I was working in the laboratory in human genetics, I always saw these people coming in, parents with children or just couples or women, and they were waiting for the genetic counselor just in front of my laboratory. And I saw them, they were, most of the time, they were very nervous, and I wondered what was going on there. And of course, I also, I mean, since I was qualifying in human genetics, I was also taking seminars on genetic counseling and prenatal diagnostics. So I asked them, first I just asked them if I could take part in one of these sessions. And they said, yes, of course, no problem. So I just listened to those sessions. And they really, can you say, struck me? Maybe it's a little too strong, but I was very surprised what was going on there.
A number of things surprised Celia Samirsky about these encounters between pregnant women and doctors with special training in counseling and genetics. One was the sheer amount of information that was gathered from the women, beginning with the counselor taking a family history.
They draw, which is a big part of the genetic counseling, a pedigree. And it's really called pedigree, Stammbaum. So they go through all the relatives, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and so on and so on. And as you can imagine, in all families there are illnesses. Someone died early, that's just how life is, no? But everything that has happened in the family in the genetic counseling session is turned into a risk. Someone who died, a child that died very early. Of unknown cause. Of course, most of the time it's of unknown cause. Maybe it was shortly after the war. So they draw a red circle around this case and say, maybe you better check again why this died. It might be genetic. It could be genetic. We can't rule it out. And also many counselors made it then an issue when someone had a heart attack. So everything that has ever happened and is considered somehow genetic is turned into a risk that the client should guard against, either a risk for herself or for her child.
This first stage of the genetic counseling creates a risk profile. The counselor then teaches the client about risk and about how to decide whether further genetic screening is warranted. And here Celia Samirsky observed what she came to think of as a crucial ambiguity. The client could hardly help but think of the risks being ascribed to her as something personal, as statements about her, whereas, in fact, Samirsky says, they only describe statistical regularities in large populations.
If a doctor tells you you have a risk of 1 out of 20 of developing this cancer, it just means that he has put you into a statistical population where 1 out of 20 is considered to develop this cancer. But if nobody ever knows if you will develop it or not. You don't know if you have anything in common except maybe this one feature that made him put you into that statistical population. You might not have anything else in common with those other 20 people. The first step in statistics is to lose sight of the concrete person. It's only about numbers, not about people made of flesh and blood.
Risks are impersonal, Celia Samirsky says. They describe not what will happen to me, but what might happen to someone who resembles me in some respect. Nevertheless, risks are what a pregnancy is made of for a woman in genetic counseling.
The simple fact that she's pregnant gives It's called basic risk. Once someone told me, oh, it's like when you enter a taxi. They start with $5, no? So if you become pregnant, you start with a risk of 3 to 5% that the child might not be normal. And then the counselors really make a list what could be wrong with the child. So they tell the woman, I mean, who somehow or should be in good hope, no? They tell the woman, your child may have a congenital heart defect. It could also have some other genetic disorders. It could have hair lip. That's, so to say, somehow the general information she should get to be a responsible pregnant woman. That's what every woman should know nowadays. What might be wrong with your child, the probabilities of all these disorders, and so on.
A pregnant woman, as Celia Samirsky recalls, was once said to be in good hope, or just expecting. Today it would be, as she notes, irresponsible to leave any possibility unpredicted. Samirsky herself has two young children, and she contrasts her own case with her mother's.
In Germany we have this mother passport. I don't know, you probably don't have that in other countries.
Not to my knowledge.
It's really called Mutterpass, mother passport. So it was introduced in 68, I think. And I looked at my mother's mother passport when she was pregnant with me. And it had only, let's say, maybe 4 pages. And everything that was in there was her weight. When she saw the doctor, that it was maybe 5 times during her pregnancy or 4 times. When she felt quickening for the first time, things like that. Very, very little. If you look at my mother's passport, I mean, you don't believe it. A lot of curves and so many entries and 52 risk factors that you could have. So it's a huge change within the last 35 years. No? When my mother was pregnant with me, there was no such thing as prenatal diagnostics. There was no ultrasound. There was no amniocentesis, no genetic screening. There was no screening at all. She was just pregnant, and the doctor maybe took some blood and took her weight, and that's all.
Prenatal diagnosis is the ultimate point of genetic counseling. Does the risk profile indicate that further testing is in order? If it is, this will involve some combination of ultrasound inspection of the fetus, blood testing, and perhaps amniocentesis, which allows the culturing of fetal cells that have been withdrawn from the amniotic sac with a large needle. It was up to the women, after counseling, to decide whether to take this next step. And for many of them, Celia Samirsky found, it was a puzzling question.
I saw many women who were at a loss after that counseling session because it's a very abstract decision. It's somehow like a managerial decision, or like a decision you make at the stock market. So you have various risks and you try to increase your chances. But in that case, I mean, a woman who's expecting a baby, this kind of mentality doesn't make any sense. First of all, she's expecting one baby. So what does it mean to her? What can it mean to her if she hears statements like, you have a risk of 1 out of 180 that your child might have Down syndrome? What does it mean? She'll have one baby. So, not 200. Huh? She wants to know if this baby that she is carrying will have Down syndrome or anything else. So it doesn't say anything meaningful to her. It can't say anything meaningful to her. I remember one session where the woman said, so now, what does it mean? And the counselor said, that's up to you. You have to decide. Some people consider that low. Some people consider that high. If you consider this a high risk, you can undergo amniocentesis. It shows the nonsense of this whole procedure, because even the experts can't really tell women or their clients what that should mean. They also at a loss.
The decision as to whether to undergo further testing is often imponderable, Celia Samirsky says. And even when these tests are done, the results may only be a more refined set of probabilities. Down syndrome can be reliably predicted by amniocentesis, she says. But even then, one still has to decide, in the dark, as it were, what that means.
Down syndrome is one of the cases where the information is pretty certain. Whatever that means, that's another question. The geneticists can tell you your child has three chromosomes 21. So when it's born, it will certainly get the diagnosis Down syndrome, whatever that means. Because children with Down syndrome can be very different. It's the prediction of a diagnosis, but it doesn't say much about the child that you really hold in your arms later, I would claim. And there are a few other predictions that are certain, but in many cases, it's all about risk and probability. For example, for a long time, cystic fibrosis was considered one of the exemplars of a monogenetic disease that you could predict.
So, monogenetic, located on one gene.
Yes, okay. Located on one gene. The idea was there's one gene and that's the cause for the disease. So, but after years of more research, they found out that it's not so easy. A doctor here told me he has siblings, or he knows siblings, and they come every once in a while. They have the two so-called severe mutations on that gene. So that was considered the cause of this illness. And he said, they are fine. They are now 20-something. They do sports. They're fine. So even in that case, from the genetic test, you couldn't tell with certainty if the child will be severely sick. You have to give parents risks, probabilities, which say nothing about the concrete case.
The difference between the concrete case and the abstract risk is what Celia Samirsky's research is all about. She thinks that they belong to entirely different orders. For her, an abyss separates the world of experience from the world of statistical probabilities. Genetic counseling and genetic screening merge these orders, and the result, she fears, is a denaturing of experience.
The woman is asked to decide about a child that is not yet there. She can't look into its face. She can't hold it in her arms. But she gets some averages like intelligence quotient.
IQ.
The IQ.
Yeah.
The decision she's supposed to make is then based on the IQ, on the average outcome of children with Down syndrome, and so on and so on. But she doesn't know her concrete child. And then she's asked to decide if she wants to keep the pregnancy or not. And 95% of those ones who get that result are bored. And I think it's not... you could say, of course, it has an effect that is somehow also eugenic because there are not so many children with Down syndrome born anymore. But I don't think that those women necessarily have some eugenic ideas about their family and having children in the population. I think it's very difficult to keep a pregnancy and to be pregnant with a child that is already diagnosed. You know, that is already put in all kinds of statistical populations, that is already, its future is already somehow, it's not open anymore. And I think that's one of the difficulties. I assume that many women would somehow maybe be very happy with the child when they would deliver it. But it's somehow very difficult to still be pregnant, you know, to be in good hope with the child that is completely checked through and diagnosed and considered abnormal.
Genetic screening imposes a decision. In Celia Samirsky's view, it turns the mother-to-be into the manager of a pregnancy. For some of the people she observed, there was no difficulty in this. It was merely an extension of an already familiar and comfortable stance. while for others it was shattering.
I once attended two amniocentesis, two procedures, and to the first one a woman came with her husband, and when the physician asked her what she would do if the result is not giving the green light, she said, "I don't want a handicapped child, I will abort, that's for clear." And how she entered that room and everything, she seemed to have incorporated that. Check the child, if it's not okay, it's going to be aborted. So, and then the next woman was a woman who entered the room and was already in tears. Yeah, and she said, "Why is all this happening? I was feeling so well, and I thought, okay, let's just do this triple test. Yeah, then I'm through with it, I'm feeling good, and I think the child is healthy. So also the test will just, you know, confirm this feeling." No, it didn't, and she was, you know, constantly in tears, and she didn't really want that. It was one of the other cases, the extreme other side. No, those women who somehow, you know, want to be good hope or are in good hope and are just somehow forced into that system. And then they do things because they think, okay, as a modern woman who wants to be responsible for her child and her coming child, you have to do certain things. So you undergo some tests to be responsible. And she was caught by that system. So to extreme cases. But I also think that most women, when they finally have to make that decision about keeping the pregnancy or not, then it becomes real. Because before it's all about, you know, numbers and fantasies. But then if you have to decide to keep the pregnancy or maybe abort, I mean, then it becomes real.
Women undergoing genetic counseling are invited to make a decision about their pregnancy. The counselors, as Celia Samirsky pointed out earlier, are generally quite scrupulous about not giving any advice. "We will give you information," they say. "Then you must decide." And in this sense, Samirsky thinks, genetic counseling enacts what she has called the paradox of taught self-determination. The decision may be impossible, but making it shows that you are free.
In general, in our society, the idea of making decisions or making autonomous decisions is considered the epitome of freedom. So you're free if you can go to the supermarket and choose between different shampoos and go to the travel agent and choose between different countries to go. So you're also considered an informed client if you can go to the doctor and choose between different options and tests. I always get in trouble with my physicians if they tell me, "What do you want?" I said, "I don't want anything here. If you consider something necessary, please tell me, but I don't want anything here." Then they tell me, "Maybe if this calms you down, we can do it." I don't want anything to calm me down. I want something that makes sense, no? But that's the contemporary way of dealing with clients. People are urged to make decisions. And there are more and more counseling services that tell people to make their own decisions and tell people how to make these decisions, give the right information to make decisions, and so on. And I think it's really one of the symbolic effects of this taught decision-making that people are asked to feel responsible to what happens to them. In a world where you can really influence less and less, also your surrounding and the society, people are more and more asked to feel responsible individually for their own fate, for what happens to them.
Genetic counseling, Celia Samirsky has written, is an educational ritual which prepares citizens for a new kind of responsibility. The client in genetic counseling is responsible for things that are imputed to her by expert professionals, for a certain constellation of genes that generates a risk profile, and not for anything that is actually within her personal grasp. And this, for Samirsky, is the paradox of the client's situation.
Those women, they are asked to feel responsible for something they can't be responsible for. And I think that's why genetic counseling is so much a paradigm for some more general development or tendency, because you can't be responsible for the outcome of your pregnancy. But all these tests and decisions that those women are urged to make, they make you feel responsible. But you can't influence the health of your child or how your child, the makeup of your child. I mean, you can make these horrible decisions of aborting or not aborting or keeping it despite all those risks attached to your pregnancy and so on, but you can't be responsible for the outcome of your pregnancy.
Genetic counseling, in Celia Samirsky's view, puts women in an impossible position, making them feel responsible for what they cannot, in fact, control. What makes this impossible situation somehow plausible, she thinks, is the idea people are encouraged to form of genes. The popularly understood gene gives a body to what would otherwise be mere statistics. It incarnates risk, and that, Celia Samirsky says finally, is its ultimate significance.
If there was not this idea of the gene, it would be much more clearer that all these numbers and all these risk figures don't have anything to do with this woman. But the gene is somehow the bridge between these abstract statistical figures and the concrete person. It merges the statistics and you, or the statistics and the concrete person. It bridges this gap that is there. So if a risk seems to be a genetic risk, it looks like there's something already pre-programmed in your body. This disease is somehow already there latently and only breaks out. But whereas in fact this risk only tells you that you have been put in that population. And it's purely a number about frequencies in this population. But it gives you the impression, oh, it's genetic. So it's somehow already inside of you. It's like a pre-programmed fate. And I think there the gene has a very important symbolic function, also in public debates. It somehow delivers the concept of a person or the body that fits into a risk society.
Celia Samirsky, recorded in Bremen, Germany, in the spring of 2007. She has taught at the universities of Bremen and Hanover and written extensively on what she calls the mathematization of hope. How to Think About Science will continue 3 weeks from tonight with a profile of American historian of science Stephen Shapin, the author of A Social History of Truth.
On Ideas, you've listened to How to Think About Science. Today's program was produced and presented by David Cayley, with the help of Bernie Lucht, Dave Field, and Liz Nagy. If you'd like an audio copy of this or any other Ideas program, if you want to know what's coming up on the show, or if you'd like to learn more about CBC podcasting, just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas. We've also created a web page for this series where sound files of the programs will be posted. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.